Well, New Year's is an opportunity to reflect, to look back. It's also an opportunity to look forward. At this time of the year, many people make New Year's resolutions, and most of those New Year's resolutions have to do with health in some way, resolve to eat less, resolve to eat healthier, resolve to exercise more, resolve to drink less, I don't know, soda, coffee, fill in the blank, try to stop smoking, try to stop, you know, this, that, and the other. It's a time to reflect and a time to look forward. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have made a New Year's resolution? I'm not going to hammer you or anything, just be honest. I'm just curious. Anybody made New Year's resolutions? Okay, a few of us. New Year's is a time to get back in the groove. I don't know if it's the case with you, but it's certainly the case with me that December just knocks me out of whack. There's just so much in December that's different, and so much that demands time and attention, and particularly me and my family this past December that we've had. There's been a lot that's demanded our time and attention, and you know, I just gotta confess to you this morning. I've let my time in the Word slip. I've let my personal devotion slip. And it's easy to do any time of the year. It's especially easy in December. And January rolls around. It's just a time to refocus and a time to get our minds and hearts on where they need to be. So in that way, it's a good thing. But just the fact that we have this time of refocus, this time of resolution, it's just a reminder to me and a reminder to all of us that we are just the type of people that need to be refocused from time to time. Amen? We have a spiritual orientation that takes us away from God. You know, if we aren't vigilant, if we don't give it constant attention, our hearts go away. I mean, just like the hymn says, prone to wander. Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. And so I pray that you will allow this time or take this opportunity that we have at New Year's to reflect and to look forward, that you will allow this time to push you, to lead you toward returning to God. And we all can return to Him in various degrees and various ways. But something that I just have felt God leading me to lead you several weeks ago, several months ago. There have been a couple of people who have approached me and said, why Zephaniah? One person even said, I have never heard anybody preach on Zephaniah, which, if you know me, that's music to my ears, man. I like going through Scripture, and I like preaching things that maybe you've never heard preached from that book before. But you know, Greg read a part of the passage for this morning, and I think from that snippet, you can get the tone of the first chapter. I don't think anybody would characterize me as hell and brimstone, but Zephaniah is hell and brimstone, hellfire and brimstone. And, you know, it's something that we need to look at, it's something that we need to hear, and it's something we're going to hear, at least this morning. I don't know if you'll be back next week, but at least you're going to hear it this morning. So anyway, I want to talk to you about returning to God over the next 4 weeks, and then we're going to have a solemn assembly the last Sunday of January, and you'll get more information. You'll find out over the next several weeks what goes into a solemn assembly, and I hope that already you'll start to prepare your own hearts. You'll pray for one another. You'll pray for our church as we look forward to that time of renewal and just coming before the Lord and bowing before Him. But this morning I want to talk to you about, I think Zephaniah 1 talks about why we need to return. We talk about returning to God. The question is, why do we need to return to God? And the first obvious answer to this that we see in chapter 1 is God's wrath. Yes, I said God's wrath. God gets angry, and God is completely justified when He gets angry. I mean, it's such a sensitive topic. It's something that Christians get flack for whenever we talk about God's wrath, because you know nobody wants to think of a God who gets angry, but at the same time, you start talking politics with anybody, and it's just a matter of time before they start getting angry. Am I right? Because we look at things in our world and we say, that's not right, that should be right, and I'm mad that it's not right, and somebody needs to do something about it. I mean, completely understandable why we get so worked up about politics. Our world is messed up. Now think about this. You know, and you watch CNN, you watch what's going on in the world. It's very hard not to watch CNN and watch, you know, 30 minutes worth of news, what's going on around the world, and not to get angry. Why? Because there's so much injustice. There's so many boneheaded things that people do that they ought not do. It's just so easy to say, that's not right. Now picture God, the God of the universe, who knows our hearts, who sees every word, who sees every deed, and he sees it 24/7. God can't turn the channel off CNN. And he sees the things that we say, the things that we do. And guess what, friends? He takes offense whenever we treat others like sometimes we treat others. God takes offense when we treat his creation like we treat his creation. And so the Bible tells us that God gets angry and it's justified. It's not fly off the handle. It's not you don't know when it's coming. You know when it's coming. He says, this is the way that you ought to live. And whenever we don't live that way, we earn his wrath. He uses, Zephaniah uses three powerful pictures, images in this first chapter to talk about God's wrath. The first one Greg read earlier, verses 2 and 3. I will sweep away everything from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will sweep away both people and animals. I will sweep away the birds in the sky and the fish in the sea and the idols that cause the wicked to stumble. When I destroy all people on the face of the earth, declares the Lord. Now that bring you to mind of anything? Zephaniah, God speaking through Zephaniah is speaking in terms of the flood, Noah's flood. In fact, some of the vocabulary that he uses here is the same vocabulary that's used in Genesis when it talks about the flood that came and destroyed the earth. This is pretty big stuff. I'm going to destroy the whole earth, God says. Animals, birds, people, I'm angry, I'm wrathful. You say, yeah, but we live on this side of Jesus, so God doesn't get angry anymore. Have you read the New Testament? Have you read Revelation? Have you read Matthew, the Gospels, when Jesus is talking about the end of the world? In fact, Jesus uses some of the same terminology. Matthew 13, when he's talking about the parable of the weeds, and whenever he says that the angels are going to come and separate the righteous from the wicked, he uses some of this same terminology. This part of verse 3 that says the idols that caused the wicked to stumble. Jesus himself, in Matthew 13, says part of the angel's job, when he comes again, is going to be to remove the things that cause people to stumble. It's very probable that Jesus is using the same kind of words that Zephaniah is using. We cannot retreat behind the language that, I don't know, we've invented to kind of soothe ourselves. Well, we're New Testament now. Yeah, we're New Testament, but God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Second image that God uses in this chapter, we find in verse 7. Be silent before the sovereign Lord, he says. For the day of the Lord is near. The day of his coming. The Lord has prepared a sacrifice. He has consecrated those he has invited. What's God saying here? Who is the sacrifice, or what is the sacrifice that he has prepared? Well, the sacrifice he has prepared, unbelievable, are his people. Judah, Jerusalem, the people called by his name. The ones that he has consecrated, that he has invited, are the Babylonians, the ones who are going to bring his judgment on his people. But here's what God says. You know, you've been slaughtering animals and you've been offering them up to me. Well, it's time for me to offer a sacrifice. And guess who's going to be on the altar? You. because you haven't obeyed me, because you haven't followed me. I'm reminded of Romans 12, 1 and 2, whenever Paul tells us to offer our bodies as living sacrifices. Walk around as dead people is what Paul teaches us to do over and over again. In other words, not my will, your will. Not what I want, what you want. How many plans does a dead person have? None. How much will does a dead person have? No. And we are like that because we surrender our will to God. And we couple that with what God is saying here in verse 7. And basically what God says is this: you are going to be a sacrifice. You're either going to be a living sacrifice or you're going to be a dead one. One of two choices. You can offer yourselves willingly to serve me. I am the God of the universe. I am the sovereign Lord. You're going to offer yourself willingly, completely to me, or suffer the consequences of my wrath. Your choice. What kind of sacrifice will you be? And then number three, God makes a comparison to a warrior. And the language here is graphic. It might put us off a little bit. But beginning with verse 14, the great day of the Lord is near. Near and coming quickly. The cry on the day of the Lord is bitter. The mighty warrior shouts his battle cry. God says, I'm coming as a warrior. That day will be a day of wrath. A day of distress and anguish, a day of trouble and ruin, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and blackness, a day of trumpet and battle cry against the fortified cities and against the corner towers. I will bring such distress on all people that they will grope about like those who are blind because they have sinned against the Lord. Their blood will be poured out like dust and their entrails like dung. Neither their silver nor their gold will be able to save them on the day of the Lord's wrath. In the fire of his jealousy, the whole earth will be consumed, for he will make a sudden end of all who live on the earth. God says, I am the divine warrior, and I'm coming after you, my people. This had to have been astounding, because God, this isn't the first time in Scripture that God has pictured himself as a divine warrior, a fighter on his people's behalf. The issue is that up until this point, God was the divine warrior who fought on behalf of his people. Whenever they were slaves in Egypt, God was the divine warrior. And they called upon him, and he showed up in a powerful way and using plagues and using a parted sea and using all kind of fire, smoke. God showed up, and he fought on behalf of his people, and he led them out of captivity. He led them out of Egypt. In the days of Samuel and David, God would show up and fight against the Philistines on behalf of his people. They would cry out to God and say, we're overrun. We need your help. God, you've got to come fight. And God would show up. And David would say things like he did in Psalm 18. You shot down your arrows like fire. You rained down hail upon your enemies. God, you fought on our behalf. You rescued us. You delivered us. You are our divine warrior. But then God's people's hearts turned away. They begin to look elsewhere. We're going to talk about this in a second. And so God says, finally, I'm fighting against you. The divine warrior who used to fight on your behalf is now coming for you. Tragic. Unbelievable. But this is what has happened. The divine warrior who was once on their side is now lined up in battle against them. So God's angry. God's wrathful because his people have gone away from him. There are three situations that describe exactly how his people have gone away from him. The first one is idolatry. Look at verse 4. I will stretch out my hand against Judah and against all who live in Jerusalem. I will destroy every remnant of Baal worship in this place. Every remembrance of the idolatrous priests, those who bow down on the roofs to worship the starry host, those who bow down and swear by the Lord, and who also swear by Molech, those who turn back from following the Lord and neither seek the Lord nor inquire of him. Zephaniah mentions two different gods that God's people have turned away from him to serve. The first one is Baal. I want to talk to you a little bit about Baal because I think there might be some misunderstanding. Baal, just the word means Lord or master. It could even mean husband. Baal was a god of the people who lived in the land before God's people came in and took the promised land. And basically, Baal offered some of the same promises that God offered. God said to his people, if you follow me, if you obey me, I will make your crops prosperous. I will send rain when it needs to rain. There'll be plenty of crops. There'll be plenty of grass for your animals to eat. There'll be plenty of water for them and you to drink. They'll be fertile. If you follow me, I will bless you. If you don't, I won't. And Baal offered the same kind of promise. And it was a big deal, see. I mean, many of us don't work with our hands in the dirt. Many of us aren't agricultural by trade. We rely on other people to raise the food and then sell it to us. But, you know, the Israelite people were so dependent on the land for their livelihood, to live the next meal. And the thing about it, God put his people in a part of land, really insignificant, really small. We're going to talk about this a little bit more next week. But God put his people in a place of the world that was so delicately balanced when it came to the rain cycle. The Bible talks about the early rains, and the Bible talks about the latter rains. And the early rains were in October, and God would send them, and they would prepare the soil for planting. They would make it where they could put the seed in. And then God would send the latter rains that would make the crop grow to the point where it was ready to be harvested. And if those early rains didn't come at the right time, if those latter rains didn't come at the right time, they were smoked. I mean, it would, you know, they were done for. And so what God said is, if you obey me, if you follow me, I'll send the rains in the proper times. You'll have crops. You'll have crops in abundance. I will take care of you. But if you don't, I won't. And so what the Israelites did is they looked over at this other god in the region, Baal. And the images that our archaeologists have dug up of Baal, he's riding on a cloud, and he's got a lightning bolt in his hand. Sound familiar? And so what Baal promised is the same kinds of things that God promised. If you follow me, if you worship me, I'll take care of you. I'll make your cattle prosperous. I'll make your cattle fertile. I'll make your crops grow. I'll send the rain when it needs to come. And so what a lot of the Israelites would do is, the people of God would do is they would say, you know what? I'm going to cover my bases. I'm going to go and I'm going to worship Baal. And how they would do it, they involved some sexual immorality, but the major thing about Baal worship, they really didn't have anything to do with sexual immorality, or the majority didn't have to do with sexual immorality. It had to do with you taking care of me and my crops and my animals and my family. Yes, God promises it, but Baal promises it, and I'm going to go look to him. Zephaniah also mentions Molech. Molech's the same type of thing, a fertility god. Just awful. Molech would demand that you offer your firstborn son to him by fire. In fact, there was a place just outside of Jerusalem where people used to offer their children to Baal, burn them in the fire. And the Jews, a little bit later on, just became so disgusted with that place, they changed it into a garbage dump. It was called Gehenna. And any time in the New Testament that Jesus would refer to hell, he would use the word Gehenna. It kind of became a metaphor for that. But atrocious, awful. But the Jewish people, some of them would say, you know what, I'm going to cover all my bases. I'm going to worship Molech because Molech offers the same kind of thing. Yes, I know that Yahweh, the Lord, God offers it, but so does Baal and so does Molech, so I'm going to serve them too, just in case. Some did it just them. Some did it just them plus. You say to me, you know, I don't have any golden statues in my house. I don't go to any pagan temples. I'm not guilty of idolatry. Well, think with me. Because like I said earlier, I mean, we have a spiritual orientation that takes us away from the living God. fact, there's just something inside of us that says maybe the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. I read a story, it had to have been about 2 months ago. Maybe not quite that. There's a pastor in New Jersey. His congregation's about 1,100 people in it. And one day he just came to the realization, you know what, I have 20 couples in my church, at least 20, who have marital problems because one of the spouses have gotten on Facebook and they have connected with an old flame and it's brought problems in their marriage. And so what this pastor said is, you know what, they have 50 people in leadership positions. I don't know if those 50 people are paid and unpaid or what, but 50 people in leadership positions. And the pastor said, if you are married, if you're in a leadership position in this church, you have two options. Delete your Facebook account or resign from leadership. And so, everybody who's in leadership, married, deleted their account. Interesting thing, it was in USA Today is where the article came from. The reporter who was talking about what the pastor did, reported the pastor as saying, you know, I'm going to suggest this to my congregation members. I'm not going to mandate it. I'm going to suggest it. But as far as my leadership, it's a stipulation. Resign or delete your Facebook account. He had a Facebook account. He used it to keep up with his family, children. And it was going to be a sacrifice for him, but he was going to follow what he was asking the others to do, and he deleted his account. And he said, you know, Facebook can be a good thing. Facebook is a way that people connect socially. We even use it to invite people to church events. But the danger is just too great. So my leadership is done with it. Now, I'm not here. I'm not going to make any official pronouncements. I don't bring that up because I'm about to, you know, drop the axe. But by the way, Phil Haverly was the one who pointed me to the article. I appreciate that. I like it when you guys send me stuff like that. Thank you, Phil. But I was reading the article, and two things stood out at me. Okay, first of all, you know, Facebook is just a thing. And we can, you know, I'm almost there, actually. I read what the pastor said, and I thought, I'm almost there. Just because, you know, personally I know of things happening like that. But Facebook is just a thing. And, you know, the problem is, in our world, things are just so accessible. Facebook makes relationships accessible. Movies, television, internet, just makes a lot of things. They're not evil in themselves, they just make the things accessible. And what this story said to me is there's something inside of us that says, what if? What if? Maybe I should have stuck with that person I dated in, I don't know, high school, whatever. What if I had? And they pursue that, and it takes them down a course that leads to destruction. It leads to pain. It leads to heartache. And the interesting thing is, you know, in our society, we've made things seem so mainstream a lot of times, but we cannot do that with the infidelity issue. You ever notice that? I mean, even in movies, when somebody leaves one person to go to another, I mean, they have to paint the spouse that they left as completely a dog. Have you noticed this? I mean, it can't be a nice person. But you have to paint it real dark, and almost like they had to, because we see the wrongness, the evil, the wickedness of the human heart that would walk away from a marriage. But there's something in us that draws us away from responsibilities, relationships. That makes us ask the question, what if, what about that, the grass is greener? And this all goes back to the condition of the human heart that looks for greener pastures, and we do it when it comes to our relationship with God. I know God tells me not to do that. I know that God says I shouldn't say blank. I know that God says I shouldn't do blank. But what if I did? It's the oldest trick in the book. You know, when the snake showed up and talked to Adam and Eve. I know God said that this would happen, but that's not really going to happen. And so we say, what if? It happens, leads to idolatry. Yeah, we may not have a gold statue in our living room. Yeah, we may not go down to the pagan shrine. But what happens when we have a plan B? You know, I know this God thing is right. I'll even call it my plan A. But I'm going to have a contingency plan over here just in case this one doesn't work out. It's almost like the guy who wears the belt and suspenders. You know, if one fails, the other's there to take up the slack. You know I trust God, but I'm going to work like a dog and neglect every important relationship in my life, ignore every important duty that God puts on me, because I need to make sure I have enough money, because if this God thing doesn't work out, I got to have something to fall back on. You know, I know God says that He's there to meet every need, that He's there to satisfy every hurt in my heart, to bring me comfort. I know that's true. I've even experienced it. But I'm going to have this over on the side that kind of tickles my fancy too, brings me comfort, numbs my heart, numbs my mind, just in case this God thing isn't quite working out. I'm going to have that on the side too. It leads me to the second thing that Zephaniah talks about, and that's compromise. Very few of us would say, yeah, I mean, we're sitting in church this morning. Very few of us would say, no, I'm going to turn my back on God. Very few of us do that. But what we do is we have a plan B. Your life should be such that if this God thing doesn't work out, if this God thing were somehow to be proven to be untrue, that you just free fall. That's what faith means. That's what trust means. God says, I want you, and I want you to want me and no other. But we have alternates. We have plan Bs. And frankly, friends, as Americans, I don't care what you've been told. We've always been that way. I read a book written by a guy, the name of Robert Fuller. And the name of the book is Spiritual But Not Religious. Do you know what whenever he says spiritual but not religious, have you ever heard that phrase before? We live in a culture where people are spiritual, but we hate the word religious, even though they mean the absolute same thing. But somehow, we don't want to be connected with traditional religion. We don't want to be connected with ritual, even though everybody's spirituality says, as Fuller, these aren't my words, this is Fuller. He's not a preacher. This isn't preacher talk. But when people say, I am spiritual, what they mean is, I believe there is a higher being. I want to somehow connect with that higher being. And so I'm going to do things. I'm going to have rituals. I'm going to have practices. I'm going to have behaviors that help me connect with that moral, with that higher being. So people say, you know, I don't want to be a part of organized religion. Well, here's a newsflash for you. Disorganized religion, the pits. I don't know what your conception of God is, but God's organized. You know, there are certain areas of my life that I'm not very organized in. I appreciate organization. Am I right? But I want to be labeled spiritual, but not religious. And what Fuller said is that almost 40% of Americans, that's almost half, almost 40% of Americans have no attachment to any kind of organized religion at all. Yet most of them still say they're deeply devout, They're deeply spiritual people. They want to follow God. Which brings me, I told you that article, the Facebook article, told me two things and only said one of them. This brings me to the second one. That pastor said, I'm not going to mandate this to my congregation. And I almost chuckled. Actually, I did. I chuckled a little bit. Because what happens if I stand before you and say, from now on, guys, nobody is on Facebook? Yeah, you look at me like you're looking at me right now. Who are you? And this is the basic issue. I mean, yeah, I know why that guy didn't mandate it. It's not because he didn't think it ought to be mandated. It's because nobody would listen to him. We live in America, for Pete's sake. I can do what I want to. Bingo. May I submit to you that as a creation of the God of the universe, you can't do whatever you want to do. Now, okay, I'm not sure. This isn't a power play. I'm not about to mandate anything. All I'm doing is pointing out the obvious. We don't like to be told what to do. That's me and that's you. In fact, when we're told what we can't do or what we shouldn't do, what do we normally do? You want to motivate RB? You tell me I can't do something. My wife tried it one time. She said, you can't mop the floor. I said, I'm also slick. I know when people are trying to get to me. You know what I'm saying? What she should have said is maybe, you know, I can mop the floor better than you. I don't know. But you tell me what I can't do, and I'm going to start thinking about doing it just to show you, Turkey, because you don't tell me what to do. And so in America, the land of the free, home of the brave, we're free to do what we want to and brave enough to try it. And we've always been that way. Did you know that at the time of the Revolutionary War, the time when God was founding this nation upon its foundations, 15% of Americans belonged to a church. Can I say that again? Only 15% of Americans belong to a church. You don't believe me? Go to New England, find all the church buildings, count the seats, do the math. It doesn't work out. Those things, they had to have had 10 services a Sunday to accommodate all the people who were in America. 15%. And from the time of our country, it was not just Christianity. It was Christianity plus fill in the blank. Christianity plus deism. Christianity plus transcendentalism. Christianity plus witchcraft. Christianity plus superstition. Christianity plus Freemasonism. Christianity plus pop psychology. Christianity plus you name it. We've always been eclectic. We have. And this is long before Oprah. This didn't start with Oprah. And what God says is, you can't have anyone but me. There is one God, and whenever we don't worship the one true God, as he has said to worship him, when we don't obey him, as he has said to obey him, we're spiritual adulterers. You know, I don't believe in a God who says you got to worship me. Really? Well, how about I put it, do you believe in a wife who says that she can be with any man and you? Do you believe in a husband who says he can be with any woman and you? Because that's what it's like. When God says, I am God and there is no other, I am husband, you are wife. That's the picture, that's the biblical picture. And you don't go running around on me. You don't bring in this pop garbage that's pumped through our televisions. No, we don't have golden idols in our home, but we have televisions that pump in garbage philosophy, anti-biblical, anti-God stuff into our minds, into our hearts. You got to guard yourself. And we bow the knee hours and hours at a time. Don't tell me you don't have idols. when you're working so much because you can never get enough. I saw an interview, I'm telling myself here. Jerry Jones, owner of the Cowboys. Have you seen the stadium that he built? The guy is stinking rich. And he says to this day, he is driven by the fear of poverty. You got to be kidding me. It's never enough. So he bows the knee. Do whatever it takes to get one more dollar, because that one more dollar might be the dollar that saves my hide. You are not trusting in the God of the universe, because he says, I will protect you, I will love you, I will care for you, my child. Well, I would never offer my firstborn in the fire. Oh, really? Because a lot of parents act like they're grooming their child to be their retirement plan. I don't say this as a... this is an ego thing. But it's not that glamorous a thing. I mean, people aren't saying that, you know, I hope one day you'll grow up to be a pastor. Give me a break. I mean, who wants to do that? No, I want you to grow up to be a lawyer, a doctor. I want you to play professional football. I want you to play professional baseball. Something like that. Make a lot of money, because daddy's going to get old one day. And I'm going to need somebody to take care of me. You go on the mission field. No, you don't offer your firstborn into the fire. Almost. Sorry, I'm getting a little off track. I'll get back. Third is complacency. Not off track, just off notes. Not always a bad thing. Look at verse 12. At that time, I will search Jerusalem with lamps and punish those who are complacent, who are like wine left on its dregs, who think the Lord will do nothing, either good or bad. Their wealth will be plundered, their houses demolished. Though they build houses, they will not live in them. Though they plant vineyards, they will not drink the wine. God says some of his people are complacent. Complacency stinks. He compares them to wine left on its dregs. I'm not a winemaker, so I had to look this up. But wine, evidently, when it's sitting there aging, there's a process that they do, is they pour the wine from one container to another. That way it still has time to age, but it's not just sitting in its dregs, which is the kind of the junk that kind of sinks to the bottom. So as the more and more they pour it, they take out the dregs, it's able to age, get better and better, but it doesn't sit on that yucky stuff. So what Zephaniah is saying is, some people are like these wine that aren't being poured from one. They're just sitting there. And they're sitting there on the dregs and just getting yuckier and yuckier. They're complacent. And notice the complacency, good or bad. They say, God's not going to do anything good. God's not going to do anything bad. God's just not going to do anything. Why? Because I haven't seen God do anything. Baloney. But that's what they say. You know, these people talk about Jesus coming back. They've been talking about that for 2,000 years. God's not going to do anything. Grow up. Get real. But notice these people, they don't just say God's not going to come and judge. God's not going to come and put an end to all this. They say God's not going to do anything good or bad. Here's, you know, you may not come to the point where you admit, no, I really don't think Jesus is coming back. So here's another test for you. Are you the type of person who says God does things good? Let me put that another way. Are you a thankful person? Thankfulness is a sign of whether or not you believe God is active in your life. We're Americans. So many times something happens good in our lives, we say, of course it did. I worked hard and I earned it. When as God's people, we ought to be saying, thanks be to God that even happened to me. even if I was involved in it, thanks be to God who gave me the energy, the talents, the ability to move my hands. Thank you, God, for being active, involved in my life. Okay, lastly, why we need to return, because we have opportunity now. The good thing about this first chapter of Zephaniah, you know, it may scare the socks off of us, but the good thing is God gives a warning when what? When there's an opportunity to turn to Him. And if God is speaking to your heart, you know, the good thing about God's mercy is He's always willing and always ready to take us back. You may be looking back at the last year and you think, I've gotten so far away from God. I wish I hadn't done that. I wish I hadn't said that. Hey, you may even think about yesterday. I wish I hadn't said that. I wish I hadn't done that. The good news about God is there's always, always opportunity for us to return. So what do? First of all, we recognize the personal and intentional nature of our choices. Look at verse 17. In the middle of it all, God says, because they have sinned against the Lord. We've got to be honest about our attitudes and our actions. It's not just a character flaw. It's not just, oops, I stumbled. It's not just, I had a bad day. It's not just, my hormones were off. We have got to be honest about, I intentionally and personally went against what God wanted me to do. I intentionally and personally knew what God wanted with my life, and I fought against Him, and I did the opposite. I intentionally wanted to make myself out to be a big deal. A couple of weeks ago, I told you that people who kind of life of the party or center of attention kind of annoy me because I want to be the center of attention. I need to expound on that a little bit. I don't want to be the life of the party. Anybody who knows my personality, you know that 5 minutes is enough for me at a party. When I say I want to be the center of attention, what I mean is more along the lines of cover of Time magazine, bust in the library type of thing. And that's just atrocious. I am a recovering self-addict, and I hope you are too. But see, Ryan thinks that Ryan is kind of a big deal. And that's awful. Because I'm not. And whenever Ryan thinks that Ryan is a big deal, and whenever Ryan takes steps to make Ryan a big deal, or wants Ryan to be a big deal, or wants people to talk about how big a deal he is, that flies in the face of the living God who is the big deal. And so it's not just middle child syndrome. Yes, it is. No, it's not. No, I got to fight against that. It's not just middle child syndrome who wants to stand out. It's not just poor me, my parents did or didn't. It's not poor me, my friends did or didn't. It's Ryan wants to be a big deal, and I want to be a big deal at the expense of God. Now, I don't have to tell you how long that's going to last. We've got to recognize that this is a personal and intentional. It's not, whoops, I slipped. If somebody else falls and says, oh, you know, just at the wrong place at the wrong time, baloney. It's intentional. Number two, lay down your weapons. This goes right along with the warrior motif, the warrior theme, the warrior image. That Zephaniah has talked about. God is the divine warrior. He's coming for His people. We surrender. Surrender is a term that's not very in vogue anymore. I give up. I am done fighting you, God. Number one, I'm not powerful enough. Number two, what you want is best. Please hear me. It's just a matter of time before God proves to you that the way He wants you to go is best for you. It is. And so we throw down our weapons, we quit struggling against Him, we quit fighting against Him. Resistance is futile. We say, God, take me, use me. And that leads to number three, lay down yourself. The remedy to being a dead sacrifice is to be a living sacrifice. God calls each one of us to lay down who we are, lay down our wants, lay down our will, lay down that sorry little voice inside of us that says, you can't tell me what to do. Lay that down and say, God, I'm yours. Where you send, I will go. What you say, I will do. God, I'm yours.